Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, December 24th, 2020. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline from today's paper is Cuba City Apartment Fire Displaces 8 Families by Annie Mell, Cuba City, Wisconsin. After instructing her kids to get dressed, Amber Drossler grabbed her phone and purse and scooped up the two cats. They didn't have much time to evacuate and needed to grab the essentials. Chloe, 12, Drossler's eldest child, struggled to put on pants. It seemed she had forgotten how in the chaos of the moment. As they ran out of the front door, Drossler glanced back over her shoulder. Smoke had engulfed everything. Quote, "Flames were just billowing out the window," she said. "It was like your worst nightmare coming true." Unquote. A fire in an upstairs bedroom at Willowbrook Glen Apartments in Cuba City ignited Tuesday night, destroying 2 units and leaving 8 families displaced. Efforts to reach the property owner on Wednesday were unsuccessful. Fire Chief Ryan Gerhard said he was the first responder to arrive at 420 East Kelly Street at about 9:25 p.m. and saw the smoke pluming from an upstairs window. Quote, "I requested Hazel Green and Platteville fire departments as soon as I got on scene and saw the smoke," he said. "I just wanted to make sure we had enough manpower." Unquote. No injuries were reported, but the upstairs unit and Drossler's apartment, which sits directly below it, were destroyed. The rest of the building sustained light smoke damage. Gerhards said he believes the fire was sparked from a charger plugged into an electrical outlet, but the cause still is under investigation. Drossler said she was sitting in her apartment folding laundry when she heard the shrill ringing of the fire alarm in the hallway. When she opened the door, she was hit by harsh fumes. A blur of what looked like a person ran past her toward the entrance of the complex. "Fire!" the person shouted. "Get out!" Drossler raced back inside to wake her daughters, Billie Jean, 10, and Gracie, 6, and then to tell Chloe to get dressed. "The kids were super upset," Drossler said. "My oldest couldn't even remember how to put on a pair of pants because you are in shock. You don't think it's real." Drossler said she and her 3 daughters and 2 cats huddled together in another tenant's garage with other residents. They were frazzled, wearing coats over the top of their pajamas. On Tuesday night, the fire department worked with the American Red Cross to send families who were unable to stay with loved ones to Country Inn and Suites in Platteville. "Drossler and her 3 girls will stay with friends in the area, and we will be able to see family in Platteville on Christmas." Wednesday, she was peppered with calls from people wanting to know how they can help. Someone stopped by with a trailer to help her load up her belongings. Quote, "Lots of people in the community are coming together," she said. "Cuba City has been amazing about everything. It's a great community. What doesn't kill us makes us stronger. It's just another bump in the road with 2020. Unquote. Police Chief Terry Terpstra said 6 of the displaced families should be able to move back into their apartment in the coming days. The exceptions are Drossler's family and the occupants of the apartment in which the blaze started. Clothing donations for families have poured in and already filled the Common Council chambers in City Hall, he said. Quote, "We all know what 2020 has been like for everyone, and on top of that, you get around Christmas, and that is your one normal," Terpstra said. "Now we have families that are displaced that do not have that opportunity. There are some single parents that are raising their children by themselves, and that is very trying on them in general, and this is making it that much more difficult, especially this time of the year. It tears at my heartstrings." Unquote. Policy would gauge carbon footprint of city vehicles. City of Dubuque continues its efforts to reduce 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions it produces by 2030, by John Cruz. The Dubuque City Council is moving forward with an initiative that aims to convert a large portion of its transportation fleet to electric vehicles. On Monday, City Council members voted unanimously to adopt a policy that requires city staff to consider the, quote, "carbon cost" of purchasing a vehicle. The policy adoption is the first step in a larger initiative to convert a large portion of Dubuque's automobile fleet to electric vehicles. Dave Lyons, Sustainable Innovation Consultant for the Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, said the policy change will allow the city to better understand the impact its vehicle purchases have from an economic and environmentalist standpoint while encouraging the investment in electric vehicles. Quote, "We're trying to introduce the concept of carbon savings," Lyons said. "There is a value to reducing carbon emissions, unquote. When purchasing vehicles, the city currently incorporates a total cost of ownership model, which includes the estimated costs for fuel and maintenance over a period of years for the vehicle, along with the initial purchase cost. Lyons said the new policy will add on to that cost of ownership by calculating the cost of carbon emissions in relation to the city's ongoing efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2030. Lyons said this policy change is the jumping-off point for the city to begin more widespread investment in electric vehicles, charging stations, and renewable energy sources to power the vehicles. This simply begins the process of recognizing carbon reduction with the purchasing of vehicles, Lyons said. When those costs are considered, electric vehicles can actually edge out into saving the city money. A feasibility study submitted to the city determined it will take between 15 and 20 years for the city's transit fleet to reach full electrification. The plan calls for the integration of 2 to 5 electric paratransit buses into the fleet within the next 5 years. In order to actually reduce the fleet's carbon footprint, Lyons said, the electric vehicles will need to be powered through renewable energy resources. The feasibility study recommends the city invest in solar power to supply the electricity for city vehicle charging stations. Along with installing solar panels on the Jewel Operations and Training Center, the study states that additional solar array sites will need to be constructed in order to meet the fleet's energy needs. City Council member Rick Jones said the new policy and feasibility study will act as a guide for local government in achieving its carbon emissions reduction goals. Quote, "I think this is the direction that we all want to go and have to go eventually," Jones said. "We've all been confused on how to get there. This gives us a foundation," unquote. Council members will also consider, during the city's fiscal year 2022 budget sessions, approving $104,000 for the purchase and installation of electric vehicle charging stations at the city's municipal service center. Lyons noted that not all vehicles can be converted to electric vehicles right away. City-owned pickup trucks, for example, currently do not have a viable electric substitute. However, Lyons said significant technology advancement for electric vehicles is expected over the next 10 years. If implemented successfully, Lyons estimated that 58% of the city's non-transit vehicle fleet could be producing zero carbon emissions by 2030. Quote, "You are talking about some pretty significant changes," he said. "This is the first step, but it's significant in the way that we approach looking at vehicle purchases," unquote. Mayor Roy Buell said he believes in Dubuque's transition to utilizing electric vehicles is necessary and inevitable. Quote, "I really think this is the future of cities our size," Buell said. "I'm ready to go," unquote. The last article on the front page is Local Colleges Assess Semester and Look Ahead. Officials share plans for the rest of the academic year after the fall term was upended by the pandemic, by Allie Hinga. Clark University's president, Tom Chesney, felt cautiously successful as his Dubuque school wrapped up a fall semester marked by the COVID-19 pandemic. Efforts such as offering a mix of hybrid and online learning and changing residence hall rooms to single occupancy units seem to help control the spread of COVID-19 on campus. Still, he knows the need to combat the pandemic hasn't gone away. Quote, "We have a good feeling overall, but we know we're still moving through that and continue to adapt as we go," unquote, he said. A As they finished their fall semesters, local college leaders said the academic year so far has gone as well as it could given the conditions the pandemic created. While the fall certainly came with challenges for local colleges, officials said their mitigation strategies seem to be effective and that they plan to stay the course next semester. Quote, "Certainly we had to do things differently, and there were a lot of anxieties in the summer before the semester began, with people knowing they would have to do a thing very, very differently. But it all worked out very well," said Donna Heald, Vice President for Academic Affairs and Academic Dean at Loras College in Dubuque. University of Wisconsin-Platteville officials reported more than 500 confirmed cases of COVID-19 among students, faculty, and staff over the course of the semester. There were 6,237 students on campus this fall, plus faculty and staff. Quote, "Especially in the last few months, we've been very pleased with the low rate," said university spokesman Paul Erickson. "We've been coming in at 1 or 2 or 3% positivity rate every day, which is much lower than the general population in the state of Wisconsin," unquote. At Clark, officials reported 157 total cases for the semester as of Monday. In that time frame, 1,220 individuals were tested. Chesney said the number of active cases at a given time throughout the semester remained below 15. A residence hall wing set aside for students with COVID-19 to isolate never reached capacity. Quote, "We were able to always sustain what we were doing on campus in that regard," Chesney said. Mark Ward, Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the faculty at University of Dubuque, said the challenge that surprised him was the number of students who had to quarantine because they were exposed to the virus. Quote, "The real challenge was not the students who tested positive, but who were exposed to someone who tested positive, and much of that was out of their control," unquote, Ward said. Students at Loras had the option to take their classes either fully online or in person with a mix of remote and in-person learning. Heald said the use of both learning models was helped by the fact that remote options were offered synchronously, so students joined at the same time as their peers. Loras moved students to fully online learning briefly this fall as case counts rose on campus. Art Sunleaf, Vice President for Student Development and Dean of Students, said the transition went smoothly and was a wake-up call for students to be mindful of mitigation measures. Quote, "In many ways, I think it helped us because it truly drove the message home that we'd been driving home anyway, that this is serious," unquote, Sunleaf said. At Northeast Iowa Community College, leaders implemented technology so students could assess their coursework even if they weren't physically in class, a practice they plan to keep up even after the pandemic is over. Quote, "This enabled students who weren't able to be in the classroom related to COVID, children sick, whatever was happening in their world, to still stay engaged," said Kathy Nakos Birds, Vice President of Learning and Student Success. The mantra was to reach the students where they could be. She said such steps as using plastic dividers, requiring masks, and creating new lab rules aimed at promoting distancing helped classes meet in person. Local college officials generally said they plan to stay the course with their COVID-19 mitigation practices in the spring. Ward said next semester at UD essentially will be identical to the fall, with classes offered so students can attend either in person or remotely. "The university's protocols have helped keep students, faculty, and staff safe," he said. His biggest concern, though, is ensuring the community maintains its stamina to keep up those practices in the spring. "I feel confident that we're going to be able to have a good semester based on the experience this fall," Ward said. I think I worry, like everyone, that we're all so tired of this, and while we see an end in sight, I think it's going to be hard for us to keep up our vigilance until the vaccine is available." At Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore, officials hope to bring more students back to campus over the course of the spring semester. Chief Academic Officer Katie Garr Katie Garrity said she would like to reach a point where 60 to 70% of courses or programs are consistently meeting on campus. Those steps will be taken thoughtfully and realistically, but Garrity said she is hopeful for 2021. Quote, "We're a community that was a little bit disrupted, so being able to come back together and to be present, I'm very hopeful for it, and I'm excited about it," unquote, she said. From page 2, the Almanac. Today is Thursday, December 24th, the 359th day of 2020. There are 7 days left in the year. This is Christmas Eve. On this date, in 1851, fire devastated the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., destroying about 35,000 volumes. In 1865, several veterans of the Confederate Army formed a private social club in Pulaski, Tennessee, that was the original version of the Ku Klux Klan. In 1913, 73 people, most of them children, died in a crush of panic after a false cry of fire during a Christmas party for striking miners and their families at the Italian Hall in Calumet, Michigan. And finally, in 1992, President Bush pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and 5 others in the Iran-Contra scandal. From page 3, Dubuque County adds 53 cases and 1 new death in the area. Dubuque County's active case count falls to 1,174. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Wednesday's developments included. There was 1 more COVID-19-related death tallied in the tri-state area Wednesday, this one in Crawford County, Wisconsin. Dubuque County reported 53 additional confirmed cases of COVID-19 between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday. The county's 14-day positivity rate remained at 9.8%. Jackson County had 12 new cases reported in that time span, and its positivity rate ticked up slightly to 12.6%. Clayton County reported 10 new cases, bringing its 14-day its 14-day positivity rate to 12.7%. Jones County reported 9 additional cases during that time span. Its positivity rate rose to 13.3%. Delaware County had 4 new cases, and its rate dropped to 9.6% as of 5 p.m. Wednesday. The State Health Department released updated hospitalization data from Monday afternoon, which showed little change from Sunday's update. As of Monday, Dubuque County had 22 residents hospitalized. Delaware County, 2. Jones County, 4. A decrease of 1 compared with Sunday. Jackson County, 3. A decrease of 1. And Clayton County, 3. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, the state was reporting 7 area long-term care facility outbreaks. Bethany Home in Dubuque was removed from the list as of Wednesday. At 5 p.m., the caseload was Stone Hill Care Center in Dubuque, 24 cases. Shady Rest Care Center, Cascade, 26. And Noble Nursing and Rehab in Dubuque, 8, an increase of 4 from 24 hours earlier. Manor Care Health Services of Dubuque, 23. Hawkeye Care Center in Dubuque, 38, an increase of 6. Monticello Nursing and Rehab Center, 72. And Guttenberg Care Center, 53. Iowa's statewide total of confirmed cases grew by 2,096 during the 24-hour span, increasing to 271,308. Iowa's death toll increased by 15 to 3,668. In Wisconsin, Grant County reported an increase of 11 confirmed cases Wednesday. Iowa County added 12. Lafayette County added 3, and Crawford County added 2 cases. Statewide, Wisconsin reported 2,579 new cases Wednesday, pushing the total to 463,594. There were 69 additional related deaths reported, so the state count moved to 4,614. In Illinois, Joe Davies County reported 11 new cases Wednesday. Statewide, Illinois reported 6,762 new confirmed cases Wednesday, along with 135 additional deaths. That pushed the state's total to 918,070 cases and 15,547 deaths. Natural gas project at Dubuque area landfill briefly delayed by pandemic, by Benjamin Fisher. The Dubuque Metropolitan Area Solid Waste Agency Board of Directors met recently to allow the company expanding the natural gas system at the landfill an extra month to complete their work due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But Dubuque Gas Producers, LLC, the local subsidiary of the parent company, Enerdyne, has made significant progress since sealing their bid for the project in early March. The project will mine the Dubuque landfill for gases produced by the decomposition of organic matter, clean that gas, and turn it into natural gas for the market. The agreement with Enerdyne includes a $10,000 annual license fee paid to DMASWA, plus 3.5% of the system's gross revenue. It takes a $720,000 initial investment by the agency. Enerdyne is the second company selected for the project after Trillium, a subsidiary of Love's truck stop chain, pulled out early in March. Currently, the gas, mainly methane, a leading greenhouse gas, is pulled to the surface through a system of 50 wells covering 60 acres. It is then collected into one pipe and flare, which burns it away. This project would instead capture that gas and supply it to an end user. Quote, "A lot of folks have figured out how to offset energy goals through wind or solar," William Brinker, Enerdyne Vice President and Operations Manager, told the Telegraph Herald. "This is a way to offset things you can't displace with those. You can put this into boilers, incinerators, anything you use natural gas for. We're taking landfill gas and turning it into pipeline-quality natural gas," unquote. Enerdyne and its subsidiaries, in partnership with the DMASWA, spent much of the year working with local engineering firms, finalizing the specs for the project. By September, the companies began a big expansion of the existing well field to collect the quantity of gas they need. Quote, "They added a few wells in the existing closed cells," said DMASWA Administrator Kent Miller. "Then they added more in cell 9, which is still being used, just not in the area they worked in," unquote. Also partnering on the project is local Black Hills Energy, which had to extend a pipeline to the site where Dubuque Gas Producers will be headquartered, just next to where the flare is now. Construction on the building began 3 weeks ago. Footers are poured, walls are up. Quote, "They've got a lot of equipment they're fabricating that will be shipped up here in the winter months and stored there in the building," unquote, Miller said. The change approved by the DMASWA board last week pushed the substantial completion date from January to February 21st, 2021, and the contract completion date to March 1st, 2021, at no cost to the agency. Then, according to Brinker, the company plans to be completely up and running by the third quarter of next year. They have not landed the kind of big-end buyer they want yet, but hope to as soon as possible. Brinker was optimistic. Quote, "Ideally, we're going to find a long-term end user that believes in sustainability," he said. "Often that can be a university, a corporate giant like Google or Microsoft, or a utility. We don't know. We'll ultimately put this into the transportation market," unquote. Enerdyne continues construction on their facility at the Dubuque Metropolitan Area Solid Waste Agency landfill off Airborne Road. The company, under their Dubuque Gas Producers LLC label, will convert mainly methane gas, which is created inside the landfill, into natural gas for sale at market. Four men arrested on child sex crime charges. The dateline is Galena, Illinois. Four area men recently were arrested in Galena for allegedly sending explicit photos to and arranging sexual encounters with an undercover officer posing online as a minor. Johnny F. Brandt, 52, of Cuba City, Wisconsin, William J. Schluning, 65, of Hanover, Illinois, and Matthew L. Colson, 49, of Cuba City, Wisconsin, each were charged in Joe Davies County Circuit Court with four felonies, two counts of indecent solicitation of a child, and one count each of unlawful grooming and traveling to meet a minor. Christian J. Dalinock, 24, of Galena, is charged with two counts of indecent solicitation of a child and unlawful grooming. Court documents indicate that all four arrests stemmed from an undercover operation of the Joe Davies County Sheriff's Department on the social networking app Grindr, but otherwise there is no indication that the four were related. Undercover officers posed as a 15-year-old boy on the app, according to court documents. They state that all four of the men initiated contact with the officer posing as the teen, and the officer in all four instances advised that he was 15 years old. All four sent explicit messages of sexual acts they wanted to do with the teen, and Brandt, Colson, and Dalinock sent explicit photos as well. Authorities reported that Colson was arrested on the afternoon of December 15th, after he drove to Galena, quote, for purposes of a sexual encounter, unquote, with what he thought was a 15-year-old boy. Brandt and Schluning were arrested in separate stings on December 17th, after each had driven to Galena for the same purpose. Colson also allegedly was driving his vehicle while under the influence at the time, leading to additional charges. Court documents state that Dalinock made plans and arrangements for the 15-year-old and the undercover officers to come to his place of work and have a sexual encounter in the restaurant bathroom. The next court hearings for Brandt and Schluning are scheduled for Wednesday, December 30th. The next hearings for both Colson and Dalinock are set for January 13th. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, December 24th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Doris M. Haskin, East Dubuque, Illinois. Doris Marie Haskin, 83, of East Dubuque, Illinois, passed away on Saturday afternoon, December 19, 2020, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Due to current COVID-19 restrictions, a private family mass will be held on Saturday, December 26th at St. Mary's Catholic Church, East Dubuque. Burial will be in the East Dubuque Cemetery. A celebration of her life will be held later when it is safer to gather. Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena, is assisting the family. Dennis James Primasing, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Dennis James Primasing was suddenly called home and entered into eternal life on December 21st, 2020, after a life well lived. A celebration of Dennis's life will be held at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, December 29th, with an open visitation from 3 to 6 p.m. and service at 6 p.m. Friends and family will be asked to observe social distancing and wear masks. A live stream of the service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Dennis under Photos and Videos or Media, starting at 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 29th. Ed Streeter, Christiansburg, Virginia. Charles Edward Ed Streeter, 96, passed away on November 25th, 2020, in Christiansburg, Virginia, at the home of his daughter with his family at his side. A memorial service for Ed Streeter will be held at a later date. Messages to the Streeter family may be sent to Ed's daughter, Pam Bontico, at pambon@gmail.com. Donations in Ed Streeter's memory may be made to the Boys and Girls Clubs of America, for either the Pass Christian, Mississippi, or Dubuque, Iowa Club locations, or to the Saul Schumann Scholarship Fund at ISU. Jerome L. Koch, Dyersville, Iowa. Jerome L. Koch, 84, of Dyersville, died on Monday, December 21st, 2020. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 30th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Burial will follow at St. Francis Cemetery in Dyersville. Kramer Funeral Home of Dyersville is assisting the family. Heather A. Stumpf, 50, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, December 22, 2020. No services will be held. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family. Steve Niedert, Sr., Marshalltown, Iowa. Steve Niedert, Sr., 73, of Marshalltown, died on Saturday, December 19, 2020. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 30th, at Engelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory in Dubuque. Alvin Reddy, Eastman, Wisconsin. Alvin Reddy, 71, of Eastman, died on Tuesday, December 22, 2020. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, December 26th, at Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Sophie M. Fiedler, Galena, Illinois. Sophie M. Fiedler, 79, of Galena, died Tuesday, December 22, 2020. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Thomas T. Frost. Thomas T. Frost, 66, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, December 22, 2020. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11, Thursday, December 31st, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, Dubuque. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday at the funeral home. Funeral services. Most funeral homes and churches are practicing social distancing guidelines recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Contact specific locations for more information. Deanne J. Bennett, Darlington, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 10:45 a.m. Monday, December 28th. Erickson Funeral Home, Darlington. Services 11 a.m. Monday at the funeral home. Hugo L. Engelken, Dyersville, Iowa. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 28th. Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian burial 10 a.m. Tuesday, December 29th, St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville. Joyce A. Hines, Postville, Iowa. Visitation 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, December 27th, Schutt Grau Funeral Home. Now we turn to the sports page, and the headline is Paulson doing a little of everything for 8-1 Comets. Bellevue Senior posted a triple-double that included school record 13 block shots to in win by Shannon Mum. Bellevue senior Teresa Paulson proved she can do it all during a recent game against West Liberty. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week recorded a triple-double with 15 points, 13 rebounds, and 13 block shots in a 50-46 overtime victory. Quote, "That was just a huge game for us because West Liberty is a great team," Paulson said. "We are so excited to come out with a win. We've been playing for each other instead of for ourselves, and we've just really come together as a team," unquote. As a four-year varsity player for the Comets, Paulson has continued to improve throughout her career. Quote, "I think I've gained a lot of confidence since freshman year," Paulson said. "This year, I knew I was going to have to step things up, especially offensively, after we lost our leading scorer from last year. I feel good about my ability to get the ball down low and take it to the basket." Paulson leads the Comets in scoring with 11.8 points per game while averaging 8 rebounds per game. During the West Liberty game, she finished with 13 blocks, a new school record. Quote, "Previously, I think my best was 7 blocks," she said. "I love being able to control the lane, and blocking the shots is always fun, especially when you do it straight up without fouling." As a senior, Paulson has taken on a new leadership role on a team that is now 8-1 and ranked 13th in Class 2A. Quote, Teresa has really stepped up vocally and on the court, Bellevue coach Rick Reed said. She came in as a timid freshman and has really taken her game up a notch. Physically, she is the strongest kid in our conference. She's just really a good kid, and everyone loves being around her. Paulson has been playing basketball since she was in the third grade and has developed a strong love for the game. Quote, "Something about the game just made me want to keep playing it," she said. "I've created a lot of friends over the years, and I can't believe my high school career is almost over." Unquote. Because of COVID-19, Paulson was limited in her off-season workouts, but still managed to work on her game as much as she could. Quote, "We were still able to have some open gyms, but nothing like we usually do," she said. "It just makes you appreciate the game and your teammates because you never know when it's going to be taken from you. It's hard to imagine that it's already Christmas break. The rest of the season is going to go so fast. I just wanted to enjoy what is left of it." Unquote. The next story is titled Opportunity Earned by Jim Leitner. Joel Vasquez couldn't have asked for a better start to a pivotal season in his baseball career. The former Dyersville Beckman All-Stater hit .516 with 4 home runs, 19 RBIs, 14 runs scored, and 3 stolen bases in the first 10 games of his sophomore season at Kirkwood Community College, and NCAA Division I programs took notice. Then the coronavirus put a halt to all National Junior College Athletic Association spring sports in mid-March. Quote, "It was hard to have it end that way, not so much because I was off to such a great start, but more because I knew I wasn't going to have the opportunity to play with a lot of my teammates from that team ever again," Vasquez said. "I'd played with Jackson Bennett, who is just an incredible teammate, since 7th grade, and all through high school, and again at Kirkwood, and he was going to be moving on to Michigan State to play. When you have teammates like that, you work your tails off together, you become really close, and it was tough knowing guys would be going their separate ways." Unquote. Fortunately for Vasquez, the NJCAA adopted to give spring sports athletes an extra season of eligibility after canceling last season. Likewise, the 2020-21 school year will not count against any NJCAA athletes. So, despite having 3 years of junior college under his belt next fall, he will have 3 seasons of eligibility at NCAA Division I Southeast Missouri State University, an Ohio Valley Conference school located in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. The 6'1", 205-pound catcher outfielder committed to Coach Andy Sawyer's program last week. Quote, "I'm so excited for Joel because he worked so hard to earn this opportunity," Kirkwood coach Todd Rima said. "You feel bad for all of your kids when their season is cut short like ours was last year. But it stings a little more when you have a guy who is playing so well and puts himself in a position where a lot of schools are interested." Unquote. Vasquez's numbers jumped off the stat sheet last season after a modest freshman year. He batted .279 with 4 homers, 22 RBIs, 24 runs, and 3 stolen bases in 41 games in his first season with the Eagles. Quote, "He worked really hard on mastering his swing and being more selective at the plate after that freshman year," Rima said. "But the difference was his work ethic. He wants it, he's motivated, and he works incredibly hard, so all the credit goes to him. He's exactly the kind of guy you want in your program because he puts everything into it and you know you're going to get the most out of him." SEMO, Southeast Missouri State, needed a corner outfielder, a middle-of-the-order guy with some pop in his bats, and Joel fits that to a T. Unquote. Southeast Missouri State won conference championships in 2002 and in 2014 through 16, and offered a sports management degree that interested Vasquez. He visited the campus during the Thanksgiving break and knew it would be the place for him. Quote, "It's a program that has been good and is on the rise. They play in a really good baseball conference, and the coaches know how to prepare their players for the next level," pro ball. Vasky said, that really drew me in. I want to go somewhere. We're going to contend for a conference championship and play in a regional and maybe a super regional or college world series. In talking to their coaches, few guys that had played there and, excuse me, in talking to their coaches, a few guys that had played there and our coaches at Kirkwood, it seemed like the perfect fit, unquote. And the off-season between his freshman and sophomore years put Vasky in a position to play at the next level. Vasky credited Rima for taking his physical and mental games to new heights. Quote, I spent a lot of time working on the aspects of my offensive game that I was good at. Instead of trying to be somebody I wasn't, Vasky said. I came into last season with the mindset that I was going to be better than the guy on the mound. I was going to swing at pitches I could hit and battle my tail off if I had to. I wanted to do damage, but more than that, I wanted to help the team and not worry so much about my own stats. Hit the ball hard and put it in play, and a lot of times you'll get a hit. Take a walk sometimes. When you take a team approach, it makes the guys around you that much better. Unquote. And Kirkwood has plenty of talent up and down its lineup. Rima's roster reads like a high school all-state squad. This year's squad also includes Western Dubuque grads Sam Goodman and Zach Bierman and Dubuque Hempstead grad Andrew Henry. Current Hempstead standout Zach Sabers is committed to Kirkwood for next season. Quote, it really means something to be in the lineup at Kirkwood, and I'm proud to say I play there, said Vasky, who won a state championship while in high school. It's a lot like Beckman in that there's such a great winning tradition and there's so much talent all around you. There's pressure to perform because there are great players ready to take your spot. Nothing's guaranteed, and you have to prove it every day. That's how you get better. Unquote. In girls' prep basketball, Rams debut in Class 5A rankings. Dubuque senior girls basketball coach Jared Deutsch is looking for hard evidence that his program is turning the corner this season. The Rams' fourth-year coach received another sign-on Wednesday with the release of the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union's fifth basketball rankings of the season. Senior made its debut in the Class 5A rankings this week at number 15. The Rams are 5-1 on the season and hung tough on Tuesday night against number 7-ranked Cedar Falls in a 79-61 defeat. Waukee holds the top spot in the 5A poll. Dubuque Wallert, 3-2, moved up one position in the Class 4A poll and is ranked 11th. The Golden Eagles just came out of a coronavirus-related quarantine on Sunday and picked up a win at Waterloo East on Tuesday night. Glenwood holds the number one ranking in 4A. Maquoketa Valley, 7-0, remained the number one ranked team in Class 2A, while Bellevue, 8-1, held strong in the number 13 position following a road win at Iowa City Regina on Tuesday night. Cherokee, 3A, and Algona Bishop Garrigan, 1A, were the other teams to receive number one rankings. Now we turn to the opinion page. And the title of this is Indoor Dining Prohibition Unwarranted by Jim Sakia, a former Illinois state representative. I've searched every available outlet. I am without success anywhere to find a sensible reason to close our restaurants and bars. They have a ridiculously low infection rate for COVID-19. It's a 1.4%. For home gatherings, it's over 70%. Governor Pritzker assures us the science is being followed. Governor Cuomo of New York ordered all New York dining facilities closed to indoor dining. They are facing a huge snowstorm, forcing them to remove all of their outdoor canopies. As a small business owner that is essential, we have been able to weather the storm. A mandatory shutdown would have destroyed us, as it is to many restaurants and bars. The restaurant and bar industries have suffered the wrath of COVID-19. I recognize that it is serious. I understand that many die from it. For 6 days in late September, I could hardly get out of bed. Yes, I had COVID-19. At age 76, they assured me that I was lucky I had no comorbidities. The blood bank can't get enough of me. They need my antibodies. My frustration is multifold. I'm allowed to go to Walmart, Farm and Fleet, and all the big box stores with my mask on, of course. As my glasses fog up, I must sneak my nose over the top, totally removing the benefit of the mask. Looking around, I realize I'm not alone. I'm allowed to attend Mass if there is space available to, what, 10% of the church capacity? Since March, the word hypocrisy is used more and more. The stories are rampant and, of course, true. As politicians order us to comply to the regulations, they then totally ignore that very regulation for themselves. Yes, thousands are dying from this evil pandemic. Thousands are dying from heart disease, but they are still selling double cheeseburgers at the drive-through window. My point is simple. America is supposed to be a free country. If you fear going to a restaurant or bar, stay home. Allow those of us who choose socialization and supporting struggling businesses to have a place to go. Yes, we have been relegated to large tents erected at great expense to the business owner in their parking lots. The LP gas heaters attempting to keep you reasonably comfortable. Is this more sensible than enjoying inside dining? There is no science at all that blames indoor dining for the COVID-19 spread. Ah, for the days of common sense. And that was by Jim Sakia. He served from 2002 to 2013 as Illinois State Representative for the 89th District, which includes Joe Davies, Stevenson, Carroll, and Whiteside counties. He is the owner of Knight Equipment Company in Pecatonica, Illinois. Now, letters to the editor from Isabel Ungs, Arrowhead Drive, Dubuque. Dubuque County mask mandate should remain in place. The number of deaths worldwide due to COVID-19 has increased drastically, with 8,000 people dying daily. Shockingly, the U.S. is ranked number one in the world, with more than 318,000 deaths. Wallert Catholic High School has been able to attend school in person every day due to mask mandate and social distancing. This has allowed the school to maintain low numbers of cases. I urge Dubuque County to continue the mask mandate until vaccinations are available for all citizens. The county mask mandate was controversial, though it is proving to be effective. According to a recent article in the Telegraph Herald, the positivity rate was 12.6% before the mandate and 10.6% since it went into effect. Additionally, per the Centers for Disease Control, masks can block 50 to 70% of fine particles that spread COVID-19 masks. COVID-19, period. Masks limit the transmission of virus particles, which makes the mandate a proactive solution to slowing the spread of the virus. Those opposed say mask mandates violate their freedom. However, a mask mandate is no different than any other laws in place for the safety of citizens, such as speed limits, seat belts, and security checks at airports. Mask mandate laws are for the greater good and safety of society. As a community, it would be a significant step towards a normal life again if we all masked up for the safety of each other until vaccinations are available for everyone. That is from Isabel Ungs, and she is a sophomore at Wallert Catholic High School. The next letter is by Scott Brenner, and the title is Illinois Shouldn't Get Federal COVID-19 Aid. Scott Brenner is from North Broadway Road, Apple River, Illinois. There is no earthly reason to dump any federal dollars into the failed state of Illinois under the guise of coronavirus relief. The state of Illinois has a pension debt estimated for fiscal year 2020 at $261 billion. The city of Chicago adds another $23 billion of their own pension debt. Giving them free money is just enabling their addiction to overspending. According to WalletHub's annual survey, Illinois residents already pay higher effective local and state tax rates than anywhere else in the nation. Nearly 15% of their income in total state and local taxes, based on the average U.S. household income of $60,602. As a result, the residents of Illinois are voting with their feet, with 6 straight years of population decline, estimated at 250,000 people lost, with 51,250 in 2019 alone. And that is by Scott Brenner. And for our last story of the day, Dubuque Takes Major Step Towards Riverfront Renewal by Eric Hugstrom. Dubuque took its initial steps toward revitalizing its riverfront area 20 years ago this month. Officials applied for a Vision Iowa Economic Development Grant from the state of Iowa. Dubuque received a $40 million award 1 year later, and it helped contribute to the largest fundraising campaign in Dubuque history. Ultimately, $188 million was raised from federal, state, county, city, business, and individual sources, and resulted in 2003 with the first phase of America's River Project. It included the creation of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, the Mississippi River Walk, and Grand River Center. Here is how the Telegraph Herald reported on the delivery of Vision Iowa application in its December 21, 2000 edition. Neither rain nor snow nor sleet or hail, inclement weather wasn't going to keep Jerry Ensler from his appointed rounds. During a heavy snowfall, the director of the Dubuque County Historical Society hand-delivered copies of the city's $58 million Vision Iowa application to Des Moines. Wednesday was the first day the state was accepting applications for the $180 million fund. Two applications, including Dubuque's, arrived Wednesday, said Susan Judkins, Vision Iowa program coordinator. Quote, "It's not a race, and being first doesn't guarantee anything," Ensler said, "but it does send a message that Dubuque is ready to go." Vision Iowa dollars would cover a substantial chunk of the cost of the America's River Project, a $188 million plan to reshape Dubuque's riverfront as a center for recreation and tourism. The project is a partnership of the city, the Historical Society, and Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce. Speaking Wednesday morning at the Iowa Welcome Center, Mayor Terry Dugan said America's River could be the state's signature project. Quote, "This is the project that will put vision in Vision Iowa," he said, adding, "It could change the face and image of Iowa. I think it's the most exciting project in the history of the city of Dubuque," said Dugan. "It's been a labor of love for a long time." The anticipated improvements equal well over 10% of the city's $1.4 billion tax base. According to a city estimate, the completed project would, in its first 5 years, influence the creation of more than 1,000 jobs and contribute $79 million through taxes and earnings. Also, construction work would boost the local economy by about $88 million, according to the city. But none of that will happen. Or, at the very least, the project will be sharply delayed if the state does not grant Vision Iowa money. Quote, "It's very crucial to make our dreams come true," unquote, said Ensler. Competition for the money will be fierce. Stewards of the Vision Iowa money say they anticipate up to $1 billion in requests, with only $150 million to $180 million to distribute. The city hopes to make a presentation to the Vision Iowa board in February. If the city lands the grant, America's River could open as soon as the spring of 2003, Dugan said. And that is probably a misprint. America's River could open as soon as the spring of 2023. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, December 24th, Christmas Eve. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.